Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, as January 31st deadline for open enrollment under Obamacare looms, doctor finds better prescription, Medicare for all, and runaway inequality, an activist guide to economic justice.
But first, today's job market is, well, it's tough on anybody. But it's especially hard for a person with a criminal conviction to get hired, even if that conviction is many years old and has no relation whatsoever to the job. Studies have shown that up to 70 million adults in the U.S. have arrests or criminal convictions. 70 million. With a conviction known up front, a person is about 50% less likely to receive a call back for a job interview. A felony conviction is even more damaging to the prognosis for employment. Well, we're delighted to have on with us now Carmelin Malalas, Commissioner for the New York City Commission on Human Rights, because we have some good news, and it's not simple to understand, but Carmelin is going to parse it out for us and tell us that New York City has banned the box. And thank you for spending some time with us, Commissioner.
Thank you for having me tonight, Mimi.
Well, this is indeed good news. When we talk about 70 million adults in the U.S. and what they face.
And in New York, we're actually looking at 5 million New Yorkers who have criminal records. So, indeed.
And those are men and women.
Correct.
Well, tell us about the significance of banning the box. What indeed the imperative of that is for, aside the numbers that you just mentioned, and exactly what has happened and how it falls under the jurisdiction of the New York City Commission on Human Rights.
Sure, and I'm happy to do that. So the New York City Commission on Human Rights is the city agency that's charged with enforcing the city's very broad New York City human rights law, which is looked at as a human rights law. In some jurisdictions, people look at it as a civil rights law, basically that contains the broad protections against discrimination and harassment over various areas of discrimination in various categories over employment, housing, public accommodations, discriminatory harassment, and other areas. And we're happy to say that effective October 27, 2015, the Fair Chance Act was passed, which, you know, as you referred to, the local ban the box protection became effective as of that date. Existing law had already required employers to do a careful analysis of the relationship between a person's conviction record and the job. What the Fair Chance Act does is it defers that analysis to a later stage of the job application process, really emphasizing that people should be considered on their merits, on their qualifications first, before looking at any sort of criminal history. So what the Fair Chance Act does, what our Ban the Box legislation does, is it makes it illegal in New York City for employers or employment agencies, and we're talking both public as well as private, to inquire about a job applicant's criminal history until they have made a conditional job offer of employment. Again, encouraging employers to consider applicants' qualifications and merits first before looking at any sort of criminal history.
So let me just take it down simply. Most of us are familiar with having to check off, thus the name Ban the Box, a box that asks whether or not we have been subject to an arrest and or conviction. I don't remember explicitly in my own case when I last filled one out and how that had to be answered. But can you tell us exactly what that box looked like, what it said, and what people have to do now?
Sure. Very similar to what you described, Mimi, you know, so boxes that say that, you know, must pass criminal background check or must have clean record, things like that, or, you know, check here if you have a criminal history, if you've ever been convicted of a crime. Basically, this law changes that chilling effect on applications. So job ads that say those sort of, or that indicate those sort of qualifications as somebody is filling out a job application, those would be considered illegal under the law. The idea being that, you know, it is illegal to ask or to indicate, to make any sort of reference to criminal history or arrest before a conditional offer of employment.
So now that Ban the Box is law, and it has been since October 27, how are you getting the word out to both the public and to the employers, and how will this law be enforced?
Great question. You know, there have been a series of rollouts in our campaign. We're kind of, the City Commission is in an interesting position in that very recently, even before Ban the Box became effective in September, another provision of the law, the credit history discrimination law, another provision that was added to the city human rights law, came into effect. And so as we've been rolling out both laws, we've had the opportunity to put on various trainings and seminars for different types of commission and community stakeholders. Hopefully, I'm hoping that you and some of the listeners on the radio have seen or heard of some of the ads for both the Credit History Discrimination Bill as well as the Fair Chance Act. We've done them over the course of the past, you know, 2 months on several different radio stations, the ads have appeared on bus shelters, on subway stations. We've had things also in various ethnic media, so that we're also trying to get out the word in folks' first language. We've been also working very closely with different types of business communities, really under the idea that in order to have true impact with both of these laws, we need to be partnering with businesses, and businesses need to see how the commission can really act as a partner and as a resource for them to comply with the law. One of the things that I'm very excited about, a new initiative that we started in June, is the commission started holding free trainings in each one of our borough-based community service centers that were specifically targeted at working with smaller employers, small housing providers, smaller businesses, places of public accommodation, where they're receiving free training on their obligations under the human rights law. Now, as Ban the Box, or as the Fair Chance Act and the credit history discrimination law became affected, we also did specific trainings or created specific modules training, again, employers on their obligations under these laws. We want to make sure that the information is out there, it is accessible, people have a free way to learn the information and comply, even if they can't afford, you know, legal counsel to be updating them on the latest developments in the law. And I would also encourage all the listeners to take a look at the commission's website. If you go to www.nyc.gov/human rights, you'll also see a lot of information there, both from the perspective of Know Your Rights for individuals as well as from the perspective of Know Your Obligations for employers.
Are you saying that when somebody goes to apply for a job, the box, the checkoff box, existed on virtually every single job application that I have ever seen, and I still have people who come in and tell me that it is there. So is the form itself deemed to be illegal, or is it just that the individual has the option now to ignore that? And should an employer demand that they fill it out, then we can go to what was part of Ken's question previously, the enforcement process. So mm-hmm. Are they no longer allowed to use these forms?
Correct. So one of the reasons that we've been really trying to reach out to various business and employer communities is because we want to make sure that this is a fundamental change taking place on applications. So the types of boxes that you may have been used to seeing in the past, we want to make that a part of the past. They should not be on any sort of applications or forms going forward. In most circumstances, those types of questions would be considered, you know, per se violations of the statute. We want to move towards a situation where those questions become irrelevant at that early stage in the process. And certainly, employers should not be forcing possible applicants to be filling out that type of information. In situations where people are finding that they are still on application forms, you know, I would suggest that they can contact the commission. They can, you know, identify the problems with the forms with employers. And you know, something to discuss too is that this is really also a learning process, I think, for a lot of employers. This is in many ways fundamentally changing the way that a lot of employers have conducted their application processes. And so while we know it's taking time for people to learn about the law and to learn about what they should or should not be doing, we also want to make sure that we or other members of the public, if that's how it's being called to their attention, but that they're realizing that those types of applications should be reformatted.
So we're talking about any felony conviction. We're talking about any arrest in the initial stage of application. There needs to be no response formally on the application. So what happens then? When can...
Well, and Mimi, if I can just interrupt, and there should be no questions about that on the application. You know, more importantly, whether or not there's a response, there should be no questions about that on the application form.
I'm glad you said that. So when can an employer make inquiry into the conviction and or arrest status of an individual applicant?
So essentially, after an employer has already extended a conditional offer of employment, and by that I mean that, you know, the applicant has already been offered the position or has already been offered the job, absent doing some sort of analysis on their criminal history. And in some cases, there are certain positions for which there are ADA requirements. If there's a disability-related issue or there are requirements that way, that could also be the case. But for the most part, it should really be the final check before the person is actually receiving the job. In those situations, after a conditional offer of employment is made, the employer may ask the applicant about their criminal history or arrest record. The person would provide that information, or they could run some sort of background check to get information on their criminal history or any sort of criminal background. And then from that information, if the employer decides after receiving that information that, you know, they do a careful analysis, and the analysis that they're supposed to do, these are factors that have existed in the law that employers should already be doing in situations where they are denying employment based on criminal history. They're looking at several factors, including whether there's any relationship between the criminal conviction and the job duties in question, how long ago the conviction took place, the seriousness of the offense, the applicant's evidence of rehabilitation. So there's several factors that should be applied to that criminal history information to determine if there is an unreasonable risk to the public if the person were to be offered the job, or to determine if there's a direct relationship between the criminal history and the job in question, such that that person is ineligible for that position. In a situation where the employer decides that there is no risk, that they are going ahead with the job offer, nothing additional needs to happen. They can go ahead with the job offer. The person can get hired. In situations in which the employer uses criminal history information to determine that somebody is no longer eligible for the position, what they're supposed to do is to provide the information they relied on making that decision to the applicant, and provide the applicant at least three days, at least 3 business days, to respond to those reasons. And let me say that there's a very important reason for this later part, for providing this additional time. You know, you want to make sure that if they did a background check, if they're using information about criminal history, that that information really refers to the specific person that they've offered the job to. And I can say that because, you know, in many instances what we find is that there are mistakes, you know, especially with common names, where there's a check run and they're really looking at 2 different people, and yet they're making an adverse decision based on somebody else's record. So situations like that.
I just wanted to go back for a second. When we talked about the 70 million Americans that have a criminal record, this, the ban, the box actually also had an enormously disproportionate impact on people of color. And I wonder if you can talk about that, because that's a critical component of this, as well as the issue of a lack of employment, which has everything to do with possible recidivism.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the studies that I have seen show that, one, you know, as I said earlier, there's about like nearly 5 million New Yorkers have a criminal record. And disproportionately, you know, it affects people of color, as you said, Mimi. You know, we think that when individuals with criminal records are excluded from employment opportunities, you know, it increases poverty and recidivism, as you said as well. And so by removing these barriers to employment, the law is really there to offer people with conviction histories an equal opportunity to enter the workforce and support their families.
You know, one of the things that I also wanted you just to touch on is the Fair Chance Act and what that explicitly does as well. And the fact that Chief Judge Jonathan Lipman, who unfortunately, and as far as I'm concerned, will not be the chief judge much longer, since there's a mandatory retirement age of 70, but he's done some wonderful things, has proposed, well, there was legislation in effect about sealing past convictions for certain crimes. If you can quickly tell us about those two things, because they're also of strategic importance and too few people know about them.
Well, if I, you know, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I think, you know, when we've been discussing the rollout of the Fair Chance Act, and we've been talking a lot about the different types of communities that the Fair Chance Act will affect, and the different types of communities that will be helped by the Fair Chance Act, I think it's difficult to separate that from kind of the larger national conversation that we've been having around mass incarceration and related issues. And I think that one cannot separate the two issues. They're very much connected. In trying to find other ways or an alternative ways to deal with the situation and to figure out how we make sure that folks who have been disproportionately affected in the criminal justice system, and as you said and as I said earlier, and a disproportionate amount of them are people of color, how they do have access to jobs and opportunity.
Well, one of the things that we were also is under Jonathan Lipman, court clerks and personnel can no longer provide misdemeanor record information to public or private employer upon request and stuff, which is really tremendously important.
Right.
So as we conclude this, I know one of the things that was very nice that happened recently is John Legend has joined a coalition of advocacy groups that have submitted a petition of more than, 130,000 signatures to President Obama, asking him to remove the felony check box on job applications. So we've got miles to go before we sleep, but New York is in the lead.
I'm happy to say that, right? So I think the city joined something like 19 states and more than 100 cities and counties nationally. But I think what's really wonderful about the city's law specifically is the breadth of it, you know, where we're looking at employers and employment agencies that are both public and private.
Well, Commissioner, thank you for this. Tell us again the website for the New York City Commission on Human Rights, one of my favorite agencies of the city of New York.
That's great. That's great to hear. Thanks for that.
Well, I used to work there, so hey.
It's www.nyc.gov/human rights. And again, please check out the website. There's a lot of information there for employees, possible employees, as well as employers, including know your rights information, know your obligations information, FAQs, legal interpretive guidance. There's information on, you know, both for our credit history discrimination law as well as for the Fair Chance Act, the exemptions that apply, because there are certain exemptions for specific employers. So I would encourage folks to check that out and to attend a commission training.
Fabulous. And I should say that there are many other things to check out on the New York City Commission on Human Rights website, all kinds of issues of discrimination that we must, for ourselves and our communities, tackle. Commissioner Carmelin Malalas, I thank you so much for taking some time to join us and informing us of this tremendously progressive and important legislation that has been enacted and now is law in New York City. Goodness, we've banned the box.
Thanks so much for this opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you.
From the sky to the sea, to the air that we breathe, from the depths of the earth to the stars.
Light up the world, light up the world. Run like you're born to fly. Live like you'll never die. Dare what you dare to dream, and everything in between.
I had an appeal. Looking at the endless star-filled sky.
Well, you see, we do believe that the world is ours, that it belongs to the people, and that it is incumbent upon us, and that's the nature of the program we do to make it more humane and egalitarian. And as we move from the issue of mass incarceration, another extraordinarily important and serious issue, because while millions of Americans now are scrambling to re-enroll in health insurance programs under the Affordable Care Act, they are also frustrated by the limitations of the private insurance marketplace. Well, Dr. Moore noted that gains made under Obamacare are not insignificant, yet he sees the defects that play out in his efforts to provide good medical care to patients.
In addition to often increasing out-of-pocket expenses, the insurance corporations dictate which specialists he can refer patients to, and he is pressured to shorten patient visits and bill them more. In response, he has, in effect, gone single payer or advocates Medicare for all, refusing to work with private insurers and now mainly accepting patients under Medicare and Medicaid.
And we're delighted to welcome Dr. Donald Moore, MD, MPH. I could put a lot of initials additionally behind that. He's a former president of the Medical Society of the County of Kings. He's a board member of Physicians for National Health Program, New York Metro Chapter. Dr. Moore, good evening.
Good evening, Mimi, and good evening, Ken. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
Well, it's our pleasure to get a real prescription as to health care for all. But we wanted to be very careful. We are not in the about trashing, if you will, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. So maybe we can begin to analyze what some of the problems and problematics are within that that have made you so insistent and driven you in the direction of Medicare for all, or what some refer to as a single-payer system.
Well, certainly I am not about the business of trashing Obamacare, because I believe that Obamacare. The problem with Obamacare, though, is that it is really an inadequate attempt to fix a broken healthcare financing system. I'm referring to the financing of healthcare. We finance our healthcare in the United States primarily, when we're not dealing with Medicare and Medicaid, we do it primarily with commercial insurance. Insurance companies that make a profit from our healthcare. That process of bringing the profit first really, I think, distorts what happens to the care of the population. Obamacare, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, did neither. It did not protect patients. As a matter of fact, people like myself lost our health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. And those who we sought to insure, we made the barriers so high that we gave them insurance, but we didn't give them access. If you go to an exchange and you sign up for a bronze plan or a silver plan, or in the case where I signed up for a gold plan, the deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurances are so high that even me, I'm a physician, I couldn't use my insurance. It just wasn't helpful to me. What I can just imagine somebody with a bronze plan, which typically have a deductible of maybe $5,000, sometimes $12,000, $15,000 for a family. When I mean deductible, I mean you pay that up front before the insurance company kicks in for illness care. You know, sure, there are some things in these plans, such as, annual exams, which may not cost the individual. But most of us access healthcare because we're ill. You know, many of us don't do the good things like, preventive care. Most of us get there because we're sick today. We have the flu and we need to get to work, so we want to get better fast. You know, that kind of care, the care that most Americans go after, these plans that are on the exchange do very little to help. In addition, the Affordable Care Act did provide for some cooperative plans, co-op plans, which basically were supposed to be consumer-driven. You see, they're all going out of business. We're back to the same old. We're back to the same old big business controlling health care and making it difficult for the average person to access their health care.
And is this situation big health care insurance corporations?
It's definitely getting worse. I just read an article today where HIP, Health Insurance Plan of New York, basically got rid of a whole group of independent physicians. The purpose of that was to narrow their networks. Now, we supposedly bring business, private insurance, into the whole mix so that we could increase our choices. But we do exactly the opposite. What happens is the health insurance companies break up into small networks. They sign up a group of physicians and a group of hospitals to a small network. Then they compete with each other to sign up enrollees, us, patients, potential patients. Then we're forced to stay in this small our network. When we try to leave the network, we're charged higher fees, and sometimes they just plain don't cover the service. So these networks really limit access to care. Now, what is the alternative? The alternative is none of these commercial insurance. Why don't we just stick with the one good insurance company, not company, but one good insurance that we have in the United States today? And I'm talking about Medicare. We all are familiar with Medicare. Medicare is how we take care of our seniors. It's been around since 1965. Medicare takes care of the sickest population, the elderly, for about 3% of the premium dollar. So when you pay the premium for Medicare, $1, 97 cents out of that goes to providing direct care. When you give that same dollar to a commercial insurance company, somewhere between 15 cents and 30 cents go to administrative costs. Administrative costs. And usually these administrative costs are not the cost of providing the care, it's the cost of denying the care. So things are getting worse. The reason why it's getting worse is because we had an opportunity to increase the amount of individuals that are insured in the United States. As you probably know, of almost 15 to 30% of the population was either uninsured and many severely underinsured. So we moved the Congress, along with our current president, moved to provide better access to care, the Affordable Care Act, Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. But what did we do in the end? In the end, we sent the individuals with the tax money, our own tax money, to an exchange and told them to buy high deductible, pretty much useless insurance. I can tell you, my colleagues, we are staying away from exchange insurance for many reasons. One, they don't pay the appropriate rate for the care that we give. And two, there is no transparency. We have no idea if we're going to get paid, when we're going to get paid. And as you can see, these exchange insurances are basically falling out of the system. They're going bankrupt. So things are obviously going to get worse. You're going to see higher deductibles as we move to the second, third, and fourth year of the Affordable Care Act. We've seen that many states have not even participated in the expansion of Medicaid. You know, New York State did participate with the expansion of Medicaid, but what did our governor do? As soon as doctors were encouraged to sign up for Medicaid, because Medicaid started paying on par with Medicare, as soon as the doctors signed up, as soon as things go in, the Congress said, you know what, let's just stop given Medicaid payments on par with Medicare, and then our governor in New York State basically privatized the whole thing. So now all our Medicaid patients with the tax dollars are going to private insurance companies who limit the care, take huge profits, and basically we're no better than we are. Now, if we had a healthy population and people were well taken care of, I would have no argument. But the United States of America performs poorly in practically all the indices of health status. I'm talking about well-recognized ways in which we evaluate healthcare delivery systems. We look at infant mortality. Where does the U.S. fall? Certainly falls below all the developed countries. Maternal mortality, you know, a woman having a baby and surviving that. In the United States, we have amongst the highest maternal mortality in the developed world. Yet, we pay twice as much as the people in Canada do. We pay twice as much as most countries in the developed world. We pay our health statistics. Barely compares to the health statistics in Cuba. Cuba has equivalent life expectancy. Cuba has equivalent maternal mortality. Cuba has better infant mortality rates than the United States. So I am not proud of that, not as a physician. And my goal for the rest of my career is to move to change this. And there are ways in which we can do this. I can do it as a physician by advocating for a more rational system. One, where I don't have insurance companies denying care, making my life difficult, making my patients' life difficult, and costing the taxpayer an enormous amount of money so they can make high profits to pay their executives. So I can advocate for that. What can we do? What can we as the patients, I can align myself with my patients, with individuals like your audience, to say enough is enough. Why don't we do something different? In New York State, right where we are, the Assembly just passed a bill for a single payer. The Assembly bill, Gottfried, it's called the New York Health Bill, it passed the Assembly. So it's now at the Senate. It's real. We can do this. All we have to do is, one, demonstrate to our New York senators that we are serious about not just health care reform, and as it was in the Affordable Care Act, but serious reform, reform that's going to bring access to care. And we're not talking about socialized medicine. I'll bring that up before anyone says, oh, what are you talking about, socialized medicine? No, I'm not. Socialized medicine doesn't exist. It's a concept to hide the realities, to hide the facts. Socialized medicine may reflect what they do in Cuba, where the government owned the facilities. We're not talking about that. Physicians are going to continue to own their practices, which currently is very hard for them to do. Hospitals are going to remain private. We will collect the premiums through taxation. We will then ensure the entire population, everybody's in, nobody's out. From the day you're born, you're insured. We know where you come from. We know where you're born. So why do you have to sign up for this? You're in a hospital when you're born most of the time. Why do you have to sign up for anything? The hospital knows more about you than your family does. So you don't need to sign up for anything. You're in. And you remain that way until you die. We know how to care for young people, we know how to care for middle-aged people, and we know how to care for older people. What we don't seem to know how to do is to pay for this care. We're paying far too much, and we're getting far too little.
Well, you've laid it all out wonderfully.
Great job.
And we are on board to push for the state Senate to similarly agree with the Assembly.
And
Governor Cuomo, what we need is a single-payer system in New York or Medicare for all. And I can't thank you enough for laying out some of the inconsistencies of flaws in the Affordable Care Act and, most significantly, what we all deserve, which is the right to a healthcare system that is available, accessible for all. And we have been speaking with Dr. Donald E. Moore, who is an MD, MP. What is MPH?
It's a Master of Public Health.
I should have known that.
Yeah, I actually, when I was in medical school, it seemed as if back then that we were going to do something about our healthcare delivery system. So I figured I needed some other than a medical degree. I needed a different perspective. So I studied public health, and I'm really happy that I did. The only thing I'm sad about is after all these years, we still have not changed our healthcare delivery system. So
well,
MPH is Masters of Public Health.
Well, with your enthusiasm, your advocacy, and bringing the rest of us on board, we're going to make it so. And that is a single-payer system, Medicare for all. Again, Dr. Donald E. Moore, thank you so much for joining us. And most importantly, Dr. Moore works with an organization, Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, New York Metro Chapter. There are many more. We're going to make it happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I love that song. That song was written by Los Tigres. And it is a song that says that, you know something, we, Latin Americans, we really are much more American than you. In fact, you crossed our borders. The border crossed me. Well, it's a great song. It was played at the Latin Music Awards, and I love it. And it's We're More American, Somos Más Americanos by Los Tigres. And we are delighted to welcome, I guess, most strategically in this season, which is so much about economics and really shaming people who don't have the money to spend and spend and spend. There is nothing in the economic universe that will automatically rescue us from runaway inequality. There is no pendulum, no invisible political force that naturally will swing back towards economic fairness, either we wage a large-scale battle for economic, social, and environmental justice, or we will witness the continued deterioration of the world we inhabit.
The arc of capitalism does not bend toward justice. We must bend it, lest Leopold's runaway inequality puts the facts in our hands so we can grasp what is really going on in our economy and what we can do about it.
And it's a fabulous book. And the reason I so love the book, I should have actually played a white man in a business suit as part of this. But, one of the things is, Les, I want to start from the back, because we always run out of time for that. This book is an activist guide to economic justice. It begins to show us what our responsibility and what we can do to deal with this grotesque manifestation of inequality, which is all about economics and the concentration of wealth and the hands of the really plutocracy. So thank you for being with us. And what do we do? What are some of the suggestions that are in your book?
Well, there are two kinds of things, two kinds of suggestions. The first is, I think, as progressives, we need to realize that almost every issue we're working on is connected through runaway inequality. The book is designed to provide an analysis that links up the various movement silos. And let's face it, over the last 40 years, tens of thousands of really good people have built up their 501c3 organizations around given issues, and they've created a kind of issue or a silo that they can justify so they can keep getting funding and survive and do good work. But we're now at a point where runaway inequality is so severe that it links all our silos, and we have to kind of make our silos more porous. We kind of have a joke when I do a lot of educational programs on this, and we call it silo busting, where we begin to link up with each other around a common agenda. So that's the first thing, is seeing that if you're working on criminal justice or you're working on housing or you're working on schools, it's all connected through runaway inequality. They're not separate issue. Runaway inequality and economic justice is not somebody else's silo. It's all of our silos. That's the first thing. The second thing are just very specific proposals that we need to consider. Many of them have been discussed by you and Ken and many others for a long time, but we need to put together a unified agenda, kind of like the populists did 150 years ago. So public banks, we have one in the country in North Dakota. We need 49 more state public banks. That's one way to challenge Wall Street. Obviously, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour is very important. Putting together a financial transaction tax, a financial speculation tax on Wall Street's transactions, would generate enough money to take care of another problem, which is indebted students. We could have free higher education easily with a financial transaction tax. So that's another one of the proposals. I think we, besides progressive income taxes, I think we need to think about a cap on the CEO worker wage ratio. You know, back in 1970, the ratio between the average worker and a top 100 CEO was 45 to 1. Pretty good, right? You make 45 times your average employee. Now it's 829 to 1. It's absolutely obscene. In Switzerland, they had a constitutional resolution that went to a vote where they were demanding 12 to 1. You know, they got a million votes for that. It was about over a third of the vote. And it was neck and neck until the big corporate money came in at the end. But we need something like that, maybe not 12 to 1, but something that begins to put a cap on the CEO Wall Street incomes. They're ridiculous. They're not producing value commensurate to it. That's a lie, a fib. So we have to bring it down. Those are some of the proposals and many others that we review. Nothing particularly shocking or unique. But if we don't put together a package of these things, this runaway inequality is going to continue. And the consequences are enormous for us, absolutely enormous. It's connected to the dramatic rise in the prison population, for one. Wisconsin now spends more money on prisons than it does on its fabled higher education system. And that's not an accident. If you look at we now have the most prisoners in the entire world. America's the world's number one police state, believe it or not. We have the highest percentage and the highest absolute number, more than China, more than Russia, more than more than North Korea. I mean, it's unbelievable. And if you look at the chart of the rise of the prison population, it was very flat from 1920 until 1980. When runaway inequality took off, so did the prison population. And that's because we gave up on having a robust public sector. We had a new philosophy, which in the book we call the Better Business Climate Philosophy, which said that we should cut taxes on the rich, cut back regulations, cut back the social safety net so that people go out and work. This was supposed to create a huge profit and investment boom. All boats were supposed to rise. But what it really did, it unleashed Wall Street. It got rid of all the good regulations we had from the New Deal on. And when Wall Street got unleashed, it proceeded to literally strip mine corporation after corporation, sucking the wealth out of the heart of the economy. The rich became extremely rich. And when the rich become extremely rich, when corporations become excessively large and banks become, obscenely large, they hide their profits, they hide their money, they move their money overseas, and you get a crisis of the public sector. So we gave up on the war on poverty. Our war on poverty became prisons. That's what happened to the people at the bottom of the income ladder. Look at Eric Garner. What was he doing when he was killed on Staten Island? He was working, right? That was his job. Rather than the kinds of public jobs that we were creating in the 60s and 70s, he had to go out and find his own job under the new regime of the Better Business Climate model. He was selling loose cigarettes. It was criminalized. He got arrested and killed. And the prisons are filled with people, small entrepreneurs, that have been trying to earn a living on the margins of society. Because we gave up as a society creating decent jobs, which is what we were trying to do for better or worse in the 60s and 70s. We were trying to put people to work at the bottom of the income ladder. We were trying to deal with inner city poverty. We gave up on that, and now we have this explosion in the prison population. If I could make one more point on that I think is really relevant. You guys still there?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's talk about Ferguson. we uncovered something very interesting in putting this book together. Ferguson is and the counties around St. Louis and many other places in the country faced a fiscal crisis because corporations either were leaving or not paying their, got a lot of tax breaks and weren't paying their full share. We can show that corporate taxes have been going down steadily for the last 40 years. And the wealthy, of course, find millions of ways to hide their money. We can show that the richer you are, the less of a percentage of taxes you pay. The poorer you are, the higher percentage at the state and local level. After 2008 hit, Ferguson hit a financial crisis. They were having trouble in their budget making ends meet. So what did they decide to do? To raise money, they couldn't raise it from the rich. They decided to raise it for the poor through fines and fees and, very, very intense enforcement of petty crimes, getting people in the court system so they'd have to pay the court fees, et cetera. This was a deliberate strategy. There's a Justice Department report that spells it out in detail. And you can see we have a chart that shows the rise of revenues from poor people after the crisis of 2008, after the Wall Street crisis of 2008. And this happened in county after county all over the metropolitan area of St. Louis and, of course, across the country. So it's not – it should be no surprise that that would lead to confrontations between the poor people, poor communities, largely people of color, and the police. And if we just attack that problem as a criminal justice problem and as a police problem, we'll never, ever solve it. Freddie Gray, Baltimore. Look at Baltimore. It's a deindustrialized catastrophe. If we don't talk about a real jobs program for places like Baltimore, the way Bernie Sanders is starting to do, if we don't talk about public jobs, ask yourself the question, when was the last time you heard a politician of either party say that the government should be the employer of last resort, especially for people who are poor in our inner cities? They're afraid to say that because they're still buying the crap of the Better Business Climate model, that somehow the private sector is going to take care of this. If we only got better education, there'd be great jobs for everybody. We knew that wasn't true in the 60s. It's still not true. And prison has become the place where we warehouse people because we are absolutely too chicken to create the public jobs that we need. That's the story of runaway inequality, and that's how it links directly into the criminal justice crisis that we face now.
Les, I wanted to just interrupt for a second because I want to also interject the question of the war on unions into this, because all of these wars began around the same time, around 1970, 1980, when we had the beginnings of runaway inequality and the big financialization that you were talking about and the criminalization of large sections of the population. So what should our goal toward be with regard to the labor movement, and what should the labor movement's goal be?
Okay, well, the labor movement was a massive victim of financialization because as they sucked the money out of the corporation, and that's explained that in, I think, easy-to-understand steps, five-step process of how corporations were financialized. When that happened, that absolutely screwed union labor. They were like absolutely boxed in. So to deal with that now, we need basic union rights. I mean, a union card check, things that would make it easier to organize. We have to stop this pitting of private sector labor against public sector labor. It's going on in state after state after state. Unscrupulous politicians are doing is they're telling non-union workers in the private sector, hey, look, you don't have these good benefits. Why are you paying taxes? Why should you pay taxes for public sector workers that still have them? I mean, that crap has to stop. Loosening the restrictions, I mean, tightening the restrictions on corporations and giving unions more ability to organize would be a huge step forward. You know, the fight for 15 is also a huge step forward. If you can raise the minimum wage, it'll make it easier for unions to organize. And the other thing that has to happen somehow or another is we've got to get rid of Citizens United, the Supreme Court case. Because that's the next thing that happens. When you get runaway inequality, you get so much money in the hands of a few that inevitably, they're going to buy political favor to get even more money. You get and you get a revolving door. Again, you know, I'm an old guy, right? When I grew up, it was a virtue to want to work in the public sector, right? It was a good thing to serve the public good. Now it's kind of viewed as, if you're really smart, what are you doing in the public sector? You should go work with, to Wall Street. So there's a revolving door of, you know, congressional staffers going to Wall Street and coming back and working in government, going back to Wall Street, making a ton of money for doing favors to Wall Street. You know, Obama's head of the trade delegation comes from Citigroup, and before that, he was the Clinton guy that fought so hard to get rid of Glass-Steagall. So, you know, that's incredible from attacking Glass-Steagall to Citigroup, and then his name is Froman, and then getting a $4 million bonus when he left Citigroup, goes to work for Obama, and sets up the TPP. So that has to all change for labor to prosper again. But the biggest takeaway from all this is we need to build a mass movement based on a broad educational campaign. The American people have no idea how bad runaway inequality is. When we do these workshops, it's astounding what people say. You know, before this book even came out, we sold 22,000 copies to unions and community organizations who are mounting a grassroots, worker-to-worker, community-to-community education campaign around runaway inequality. That's what the populists did in the 1880s. They had 6,000 lecturers, they called them, educators, that went around the country telling their story about how Wall Street was screwing them. We need about 30,000 to match our population. But if we even had a few thousand, it would make an enormous difference. Communication Workers of America in the New York area sort of leading. They're doing the first pilots on this, training their own workers who are helping them to use this book as a template for reaching other workers and telling the story, and then building a common agenda that can link them with community groups and other unions to take on Wall Street.
Les, let me ask you this in 30 seconds.
Go ahead.
Are you happy with the way in which Bernie Sanders is framing the issues around inequality? And I must admit, I haven't heard one single solitary word about TANF, about the issue of welfare. But so I'm not very happy. Are you?
Well, part of me is because he took one of my proposals that I made 5 years ago,
he stole
the financial transaction tax leading to free higher education. Look, Mimi, I think it's a start. He's not going to build the movement by himself, but he opens the door.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we had Occupy Wall Street, and what did they do? In 6 months, they got on the agenda, the 1% and the 99%. They did a good job on that, but they're not there anymore. Then we had Elizabeth Warren, who's still doing a good job raising some issues. Bernie's taking it a step forward. Now it's going to be up to the rest of us to actually build a national organization. You know, I'm a believer in organization. That spontaneous combustion is not going to work. I think, Occupy Wall Street kind of proved that. We need real organization. We need to have groups that have members.
You know something, we're going to have to leave it there on real organization and tell people you need to get a copy of Runaway Inequality, which is designed to address the problems faced by everyday working people with charts and graphs, and it's digestible and it's readable, because we need a mass movement to address runaway inequality, and Les Leopold helps us do that. Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice by Les Leopold, put out by Labor Institute Press. And thank you for joining us, and thank you for the important work you do. We got to stop runaway inequality.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, reminding you to listen to Mimi Rosenberg this Wednesday and every Wednesday morning from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m.
And we get ready now for Scott Sommer with Housing Notebook. And we always link the issues of income, or the lack thereof, with the ability to continue to live in this city. And it's nice to say hello to Scott, who hasn't been with us for a few weeks. Have a good evening. Continue to organize. Stay vigilant. Yes, we can stop runaway inequality.
longtime meteorologist Tom Weissmuller. Every year, I do the annual winter forecast for the New York region. I've done it 6 times in a row and been dead right. See if I'm right this year. It'll be on the 24th of November on Ken.